We are, as Jews, we are clearly caught up in all that's going on in Israel and by extension throughout the world. What is it that drives so much energy around Israel? Why does it touch a Jew so deeply? Why does it evoke such hatred? So we're not going to have all of the answer, because that's, as King Solomon says, that is longer, its measure is longer than the earth. But we're going to tap into some of the spiritual energy of what Israel is all about. And in so doing, we'll get some insight into what makes Israel so holy. And the nature of things are that whenever there's a positive energy, there's always a negative force that attempts to dismantle it. That is as old as time, brought down in the prophets. It says, "Zeh l'uma zeh asa Elokim," this opposite that God created. God created it such in order for there to be an even playing field. If goodness was dominant, then we wouldn't struggle so much. And if we didn't struggle, the choice wouldn't make that much of a difference, wouldn't be that meaningful. So in order for the choice to make a difference, there has to be a struggle. In order for there to be a struggle, there has to be a playing field. And the playing field, for it to be a fair fight, has to be balanced. So whenever you have something positive, you always have a counterforce, a negative counterforce. So let's understand what is the force of Israel. And in so doing, we'll learn about what the counterforce is, at least one of the counterforces, to give us an understanding of where that tension comes from. So we're going to jump right in. This is a discourse that comes from the Alter Rebbe, the first of the Chabad Rebbes, whose Yahrzeit anniversary of passing was this past Friday. The Alter Rebbe shared many discourses, and these discourses were later on compiled in two books. The first one is called Torah Or, which covers the Torah portions of Bereishis and Shemos. Let me rephrase that. The Alter Rebbe said many discourses. They're actually recorded in volumes that record the discourses based on the years that he said them. And there are many such volumes. The Alter Rebbe wrote the Book of Tanya. He's the author of the Book of Tanya. The book that we're studying from in particular comes from a two-volume book the first volume is called Torah Or, which covers the Torah portions of Bereishis and Shemos, Genesis and Exodus. And the second one is called Litkutei Torah, which means a compilations of Torah teachings that covers the books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Vayikra Bamidbar and Devarim. In addition, there is at the end of these of the second volume, there are discourses on Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. King Solomon's Song of Songs is a very mystical, very Kabbalistic story or song, discussion, love story, and the Alter Rebbe unpacks it in many discourses. It's very fascinating, unpacks some of the mystical teachings behind the Song of Songs. And then there's also Megillas Esther, a commentary on the Megillah of Esther. These were extracted from the many discourses that the Alter Rebbe offered specifically for these Torah portions and for these commentaries on Song of Songs and the Megillah of Esther. And they're known as the Hasidic Torah portion. And many people have a tradition to study these on Shabbat morning, to study them throughout the week. But it's at its core, it's the deeper meaning behind the stories of the Torah as they're understood through the lens of Jewish mysticism and Chabad philosophy. So the discourse that we are studying is based on the story of the spies. Let's set the stage for the story of the spies, and then we'll jump into the text. So the Jewish people, yesterday we began the story of the Jewish people in the Egyptian exile. And after after being in exile for 210 years, they are redeemed. Moses is sent by God to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. 49 days later, they stood at the foot of Mount Sinai, where they received the revelation at Sinai, the giving of the Torah. Over the next year and change, they traveled in the desert. Along the way, they made the golden calf. God forgave them, gave them the second tablets, instructed them to build the Mishkan, the mini portable temple, the portable synagogue that accompanied them in the desert. And they celebrated the first anniversary of the Exodus from Egypt. And then a short while later, the Jewish people were scheduled to go into the land of Israel. And the Jewish people approached Moses and they said, we want to send some spies into the land to see if we can do this. So Moses consults with God. Should I let them send the spies? Should I send the spies? And God says, Shlach lecha, send for yourself. Which means, if you think it's a good idea, you should do it. And if not, then you shouldn't. I think when God tells you, if you think it's a good idea, and he doesn't say yes, you probably shouldn't do it. But God was obviously creating an opening, and he says to Moses, if you think you should do it, you should do it. And Moses decides to do it. So he sends the spies, he takes leaders of each of the 12 tribes, so 12 spies, and he sends them into the land. And 10 of the 12 return with a negative report. And they say the land is mighty, it's fortified, there are giants that live there. Look at these fruit. They brought back the massive fruits of the land of Israel. And they said, we cannot conquer it. We can't do it. They're stronger than us. They're stronger than God. There were two of the tribes, Caleb and Yehoshua, Caleb and Joshua, who, as the Medrash tells us, they went to Hebron. They went to Hebron to pray at the gravesite of their forefathers. Caleb in particular, Joshua was blessed by Moses before he left that God should save him from the council of the spies. End of the story is they came back with a positive report and they tried to convince the people that not to listen to the report of the 10, but the people were ready to buy into the story. They bought the story of the 10 spies and God said, okay, that's enough. That's it. I've had it. You've pushed the limit. Now you guys are not going into the land of Israel. You're not worthy of going into the land of Israel. You're going to die in the desert. And it's only the next generation who hasn't witnessed all my miracles. They are the ones that are going to go into the land of Israel. The spies themselves die in a very unnatural way. The rest of the Jewish people, you know, sometimes, what is it? Who is it said that any club that wants me, I don't want to be a part of? What was that? Okay. So sometimes like you tell them you can have it and then I don't want it. But then you say you can have it, then you want it. So the Jewish people said, oh, now we can't go in. No, we're going to go. We're going to go anyway. Like this is such a special thing. We learned our lesson. We're going to go anyway. So don't do it. You're making a mistake. And many Jews went up to fight and they were actually beat down. Many Jews were killed in that battle. So they got the message and they spent the next 38 years in the desert. And ultimately, after that generation, that entire generation died out, the next generation merited to go into the land of Israel under the leadership of Joshua and ultimately conquered the land of Israel. So that's the story. So there's a lot to understand about this story. Let's jump right in. Shlach lecha anashim, send for yourself men. Inyan ha-meraglim, shayu nesiei ha-eda anshei shem. The spies are, the idea of the spies is that they were the princes of the congregation. They were men of renown. They had a good reputation. U'matam sheli ratzu l'kanis l'aretz Yisrael. So the first question is, why did they not want to go into the land of Israel? These were leaders of the people. Also to understand what is Israel? What is Israel all about? What is this spiritual level of Israel that evokes such tension around it. So hiniksiv ha'aretz asher nesati lahem eretz zavas chalav u'devash. We know the verse tells us, we read it in yesterday's Torah portion, that the land of Israel is a land flowing with milk and honey. Did you ever stop to think what that means? It's a land flowing with milk and honey. What does that mean, it's flowing with milk and honey?
Sweet.
What part of who? Have you met an Israeli?
It doesn't mean it's fertile. But...
What'd you say?
Honey Nut Cheerios.
Honey Nut Cheerios. What are you saying? That it's fertile?
That flowers.
So it's specifically talking about, I'm forgetting what the milk refers to, but the honey refers to date honey. We know that Israel is well known for its dates. There are seven kinds that Israel is praised for. Let's see if I can remember all of them. Figs, dates, grapes, pomegranates. One more fruit. Figs, dates, pomegranates. No. Dates, figs. No, that's more modern. Olives. And then we have wheat and barley. Right? So this is brought down in the verse that spells this out. So the honey is specifically talking about date honey. The milk, I'm not remembering right now what it's referring to. But it's not flowing on the ground. Right? It's not like it's flowing. Now, flowing could mean there's an abundance of it, perhaps. And all good. In other words, it's fertile. It has these wonderful fruits. It tells us the Medrash tells us when the spies came back, they carried one cluster of grapes on the shoulders of four people. So these were massive, massive grapes. These were delicious, massive fruits. If you've been to Israel, I've traveled with high society. I go with the Atlanta Federation. They want to impress the donors, so we go on the trip. We get to stay at the David Citadel. There's nothing better than breakfast at the David Citadel. Morning breakfast at David Citadel, fresh fruit, fresh vegetables. It's like a different, you can't find it anywhere in the world. So yes, it's wonderful. But we're talking about something else here. For the Torah to go out of its way to praise Israel as a land flowing with milk and honey, there must be something more than just the physical fruit. And that's the Alter Rebbe's question is, Uma shevach huzeh? What is the praise? What is this praise of milk and honey? Chatzarach lahavin, as it is with all of the teachings of the Alter Rebbe, and in many Hasidic, I shouldn't say all of them, but many Hasidic discourses will take a detour. We're going to go around, climb up some mountains, down some valleys, and then eventually we come back to the point upon which the discourse was founded. So, Achzach lahavin di nikola mitzvahs maisiyos, rubam kukulam tluyim dafka be'eretz Yisrael, ubefrat inyanei zirayim v'kotchim. We have to understand something. Many mitzvot, many of the action-based commandments, are dependent on the land of Israel. I can't give you an exact number, but if you look at the entire book of Leviticus, for the most part, is about sacrifices. Sacrifices can only be offered in the land of Israel. In fact, not only in the land of Israel, only when the temple is standing. Additionally, we have many laws associated with produce, with the fields, with planting, harvesting. There are some of them that apply even in the diaspora, but for the most part, the obligation that surrounds the various different laws associated with the land are dependent on the land of Israel. They're obligatory only in the land of Israel. So just to kind of throw a bunch of laws surrounding that, you have the obligation to leave the corner of the field for the poor. when you're gathering bundles to leave, and a bundle, you forget a bundle in the field, you have to leave that in the field. If you're collecting grapes and you drop a cluster, you have to leave that in the field. We have to tithe. There are multiple tithes. There's truma, there's Maaser Rishon, Maaser Sheni, there's Maaser Ani. There's the sabbatical year that the land has to rest. There's the Jubilee year. There's the land, there's the laws regarding servants and slaves and when they have to go free and when they're not allowed to go free. And all these are all associated with the land of Israel. So it's some significant number of the 613 commandments in the Torah are directly dependent on the land of Israel. So if you want to take on a fully observant life, you should know that there's not 613 available today. If you're living in Atlanta, for sure not. So it's maybe not that difficult. And in parentheses, the Alter Rebbe tells us, "Uvamidbar hayu karbanos lefisha." In the desert, even though they were not yet in the land of Israel, they did have sacrifices, but that was a temporary state. In other words, the portable synagogue that accompanied the Jewish people in the desert, when they came to the land of Israel, all of the sacrifice structure was moved to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle that was based in various places in Israel, in Shiloh and Nov, and then eventually in Jerusalem, and then eventually in the temple. And all other sacrifices were prohibited at that point. So there was the permission to offer sacrifices we find throughout the Torah. We find Abraham brought sacrifices, Isaac, Jacob. In the desert, they brought sacrifices. But once they came to Israel, sacrifices became focused only on the place where the Mishkan was, where the tabernacle was. And then later, as we read in the prophets, when the temple was built, it was exclusively in the temple. But while they were in the desert, they still had access to some of these commandments. Okay, so what is that all about? What is it that the majority of the commandments of the Torah are dependent on the land of Israel? By the way, we already at this point, we already have an inkling of something about what sets Israel apart, right? We already are highlighting this idea that Israel is unique in that the majority of the commandments can only be observed in Israel, which already tells us something about the nature of the land of Israel. There's something unique about that physical space that brings with it this idea of the capacity and the ability to do commandments there. By the way, for those not familiar, at any point, you are welcome to ask questions. And disagreement or challenge is welcome here. Hiniksiv, not that we said anything controversial yet. Hiniksiv, it is written, Ki loy al alechem levada yichya ha'adam ki al kol meitzei pi Hashem. It says in the Torah, not by bread alone does man eat, but rather on all that comes out of God's mouth. But Tzarech Lavan, we have to understand, Hayisrein shebelechem, the advantage, what is the superior quality of bread? The person themselves was created by God's utterance. Like God says, let us make man. Why is it that man needs to receive his sustenance from bread? So let's explain what the question is here, the context of the question. So we are human beings. And one of the things I find fascinating every year on Yom Kippur is that about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, for some people it starts at 11, for others it's at 8. You know, when the caffeine, missing the caffeine kicks in, right? And others it's when lunch, when you miss, you know, when the lunch time passes. Most of us can skip breakfast, right? But then when it hits lunch, and it's past lunch, we start getting a little kvetchy, a little irritable. And I always find it, I'm not a great faster. I do not like fasting. I'm not a great faster. But I try to bring a little humility into the experience by recognizing, just look at yourself. Look at myself. I didn't have coffee this morning. I didn't have my breakfast this morning. I missed lunch and I'm falling apart. Think about it. You know, like, look what I'm dependent on. Look at what my life is dependent on a cup of coffee, on a bowl of cereal, on a bowl of oatmeal, on a container of yogurt, right? You open up the news and you see the nonsense that is going on in the world. Elon Musk, they're all concerned about the future of his companies. And there's so much nonsense out there. And yet these people about whom there's so much nonsense, if they miss lunch and dinner for an entire day, they're going to start falling apart. And we fall apart. Why are we so dependent? Why are we so dependent on food? Right? Tell me that we're dependent on, you know, great intellectual ideas. That we can't survive without them. Okay, that's uplifting. But that you didn't have your sandwich this morning, you know, you're falling apart. It's a very humbling thought. So the Torah tells us, it's lo yala lechem levadi yichya ha'adam. It's not the bread that man lives off of. We live off of the word of God that's in the bread. Life is not dependent on bread. Life is dependent on God. God has found the energy, the divine energy that gives us sustenance, the divine energy that keeps our body and soul together is found in the bread, it's found in the food. Baal Shem Tov says that when a person is hungry for a particular food, it's because the divine energy in the food is calling out to them to elevate that food. Some people are very religious about that. There's a lot of food that calls out to them. There's a lot of sparks that they have to elevate. But the idea is that there's a divine energy in the food that needs to be consumed in order to elevate that food. So the Alter Rebbe asks a question. Where is the word of God in the bread? So at the beginning of creation, the very beginning of Bereishis, beginning of Genesis, we have what's known as the Asara Maimaris, the 10 utterances. If you look in the text, it says, Vayomer Elokim Yihi Or, God said, let there be light. And God said, let there be a firmament. And God said, let the earth bring forth its fruit and its grass and its produce and so on. In the words that God uttered to create this world, to bring forth the produce from the earth, the word of God is in the produce. It's in the food. It's in the bread. And it's not a one-time event, but as we say in the prayers every single day, HaMachadesh B'tuvei B'chol Yom Tamid, He renews in His goodness every single day constantly the work of creation. The world is constantly being recreated. And since the world is constantly being recreated, there's a divine energy in every piece of food that we eat. And every time we eat, we extract that energy, that divine energy. It goes into our body and it becomes a bridge between body and soul. So that's the mechanism. And so when your soul is not getting the food that it needs, it's not getting that divine energy. And we're so accustomed to it, and we so need it, that when we don't have it, we start falling apart. But here's a question that the Alter Rebbe is asking here. There's also an utterance to bring the human being into existence. As the Torah tells us, God said, Na'asa adam b'tzalmeinu b'kidmuseinu. Let us make man in our image, God says. In other words, God, the same utterance that God said to bring forth the produce is the same utterance that created the human being. So why does the human being need to draw that energy from something else when they themselves have that energy? What makes the energy in the bread more powerful than the energy that's in me? And let's take it a step further. We know in the teachings of Hasidus and Jewish mysticism, that there are four categories of existence. We have the inanimate, we have vegetable life, we have animal life, and we have human life. Human life is the highest of the four. So why does human life need to sustain itself off of a lower life form? Vegetable life. We also draw sustenance from animal life. And we also draw sustenance from inanimate, right? Certain minerals we also require to live. So we actually need all three, the proteins, the animal proteins that give us sustenance. But the reality is that the bulk of our food is vegetable. It's earth produced, right? We also, you know, what is it, the keto diet, right? So you could. These are not necessarily good ways to live life. You know, maybe they work to lose a little bit of weight, but they're not. Healthy diets have an abundance of fruits and vegetables and grains, And then it has a little bit. You can't have too much salt, right? Then you get in trouble. Or too much of some of the other minerals. You have just the right amount. And vegetable life, animal life is a add-on, right? You get your piece of steak and your potatoes and your vegetables, and right? You don't have a piece of steak. I mean, some people do, yeah. But it's not a healthy way of living. So why is it that man requires vegetable life to extract or life produced from the earth to extract the divine energy when the same word of God is found in the human life, which is higher than that? Make sense?
Fine.
We never stop to think about it, right? Achinyan hu, the answer is as follows. Ki moitze pi Hashem, shebedoimim tzemeachai. The word of God that is found within the inanimate, the vegetable life, and the animal life, hu inyan harepach nitzutzim shenaflu b'shviras hakelim. These are the specific 288 sparks that fell at the time of the shattering of the vessels. I'm going to read another line and then I'll explain. V'ha'adam hu mehatikun. Man, the human being, comes from the world of tikun, the world, the corrected world, the fixed world. V'lachein sarach ha'adam l'ka b'chayusay midatzach davka. And therefore, the person requires to draw their energy specifically from the lower three dimensions. So let's go back to the beginning of time. One more line. Because the sparks, the source of the 288 sparks, has a much higher source as it's explained elsewhere. Everybody knows the opening verse of the Torah. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Who knows how the second verse begins? Go ahead.
State it as the earth was without form and void.
Good. The ha'aretz ha'isa sayu v'vayu. So when I learned it, they translated it, and the earth was chaotic and empty. But the idea is there was a tumult. It wasn't straight. It wasn't balanced. It was a crazy world. It was an imbalanced place. And there was darkness over the face of the depth. And the Spirit of God was hovering on the face of the water. That's verse 2. And verse 3 is, Vayomer Elokim Yihi Or, God said, let there be light, Vayihi Or, and there was light. So if we think for a moment about the sequence of these verses, let's just try to tap into the energy of what's going on. The opening verse is an introduction. Once upon a time in a faraway land, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The second verse tells us, and the earth was chaotic and empty. It was filled with void, and darkness was over everything. And the Spirit of God hovered over all of it. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. So the God saying, and let there be light, and there was light, tells us that this prior state of chaos suddenly got some order to it. The light was shined on it. So what's this middle state? What's this chaotic state? And again, in context, as I mentioned earlier, we say in the prayers every single day that God renews in his kindness every day the work of creation. The work of creation includes this state of chaos. It's not a one-time event. It's a constant. It's a recreating. Every single day, there is every single moment, every single millisecond, whatever that means in the space above time, there is this recreation of this process of, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, the chaos and the order. So it behooves us to understand, what is this chaos and why is it being recreated? What's happening here? So I'm going to use the basic description that's brought down in Chassidus to give us an analogy, a parallel, to be able to understand this. We'll use kindness and judgment as the framework, or kindness and discipline. Kindness is a good thing, yes? Discipline is a good thing, yes? You're shaking your head, wondering. Tell me why.
Well, I think it can be contextual. Like, if you're receiving discipline, maybe people don't appreciate it as good always.
Okay, that doesn't make it not good, though.
That's what I was...
But I'll take your shaking head in a different way, because sometimes discipline is misplaced, as is kindness. Misplaced kindness actually is very harmful. Misplaced discipline is very harmful. So, for example, you have a first-time offender of a minor offense that comes in front of a judge. The law gives the judge a wide range of sentencing guidelines, right? When a first-time offender who committed a minor offense comes in front of a judge, and the judge, why does the judge have such a wide range of sentencing guidelines? Because sometimes you have this arrogant first-time offender who thinks they're above the law, who shows up and needs to be put in their place. So the law gives the judge the ability to look at this first-time offender and say, "You little schmo, you have no humility here. We're going to throw the book at you. It's the only way you're going to learn." But then you have the other guy who comes in there who did a minor offense and feels bad, and you know, just his desire, his temptation got the better of him, right? And the judge should give him a minor sentence. So when the judge uses the other extreme of the discipline, that's not good for the child. Here's a very interesting parenting thing that unfortunately I didn't learn until most of my kids were too old to be on the receiving end of it. Maybe the little ones got a little bit of the upside of it. The older ones can't understand why we deal with the little ones that way, but that's a different story. But the idea is like this. We have this notion that when a child does something wrong, they need to be punished. There needs to be a consequence. And therefore, and that's something that we picked up from our parents. It's generational. The fact is, children don't necessarily always need a consequence. They just need to know that something that they did was not good, wasn't right. Doesn't mean they never need a consequence. But we have this notion that if we don't give them the consequence, they're never going to learn. That discredits the capacity for a child to learn and to absorb. They just need to know that this behavior is not good. And they need to constantly be just relocated from the negative behavior. Not to be punished, not to give them, you know, put them in time out or stuff like that. They just need to know. Again, I'm not saying there's never a place for that. But we have this notion that every time a child does something wrong, if we don't give it to them now, they're going to turn out to be a monster, right? It's not so. Sometimes they just need awareness. Sometimes they do need discipline. Sometimes they do need a consequence. I will confess a sin on public YouTube. When I was a little kid, I don't remember how old I was. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. One night, we went to the supermarket, and it was Halloween time. And I swiped some candies out of the basket, put them in my pocket, came home. And besides the fact that they weren't kosher, which was one problem, I also stole them. And I was in my bed at night, and I'm crinkling the candies. And my older brother calls my father, "Tati, Elio stole candies. He's eating candies." My father came to him. Like, to me, it was probably like midnight or something. That's my memory. My father came in. He discovered what I was up to, made me get dressed, took me to the supermarket, called the manager. I had to tell the manager what I did, gave back the candies. My father, of course, paid for the candies. And I don't even know if I got any punishment for that. I think just that event alone kind of conveyed a message to me. Okay? So it doesn't always need a punishment. Accountability, right? Accountability sometimes is adequate. So kindness, now that's been all on the discipline side. On the kindness side, I use this analogy because it's a very difficult one for us to navigate. You get off the highway, there's somebody standing there, you know, homeless veteran, need food, need work, right? And you want to help them. But for all you know, they're an alcoholic or a drug addict, and you're feeding their addiction. So what do? So we've gotten wise. There's certain kind people keep a sandwich or a bar in their car. And I mean, like a nut bar, not like a bar. But, you know, when they get off the highway and they see somebody standing there, they hand them over a granola bar or something, a nut bar. You're hungry. I'll give you food. Right? What happens if you don't have food in your car? You want to help the person. You have this feeling that you want to help the person, but you don't know if it's good for them. And chances are it's not good for them. Chances are it's not good for them because they have resources. There are resources out there for people to get help. Again, I'm not making any blanket statements. It's not a political statement. I'm just saying is that we have this tendency to want to help. Or when the child wants the candy and you know that they're going to cry, if you don't give them the candy, or if you don't let them stay up for just another hour, right, the night before the wedding or something, you want to give in to that. And that the wanting to give in is coming from a good place. It's not a bad place. It's not necessarily a wholesome place, but it's a good place. It's a desire to want to do, to see happiness, to see goodness around us. But sometimes that kindness is not good. Sometimes that kindness is a negative. You have to hold back that kindness because that is the goodness. The real goodness is not giving. Or to use a more expansive analogy, rain is blessing. Rain is kindness. But if there's no control to the rain, if there's no discipline, so to speak, from God's vantage point on the rain, you have a flood. So while rain can be very good for the earth, if there's no control on the rain, if the rain is just coming in torrents, it washes away the earth. So kindness and discipline are wonderful things, but they need balance. Can you imagine a world in which kindness doesn't need balance and pure kindness can exist, as can pure discipline? It's really impossible for us to understand, to comprehend such a world, because we live in a world of tikkun. We live in the world, the corrected world. And in the corrected world, everything needs balance. You got to sleep a number of hours, you got to be awake a number of hours, you got to work in order to eat, you got to exercise in order to be healthy, right? We live in this world of balance where things are balanced. That's the way they're supposed to be. But if you can lean into the idea that kindness as a value can have its pure state, because kindness is good, as is discipline, as are the other eight of the 10 sephiros: wisdom, understanding, knowledge, kindness, discipline, harmony, endurance, humility, bonding, and royalty. So each one of these qualities, which make up the functionality of the human being, the intellectual components and the emotional components, each one has a value into itself. For a second, we'll touch on the intellectual ones. Chachma is the spark of a new idea, the genesis of a new idea. Now we know we have these light bulbs, right? That's what it means. A light bulb goes off, right? If you don't take that light bulb and do something with it, develop it, it's gonna go away. So you get a new idea, you have to take the idea and you have to develop it. Now there are some people that are great at new ideas. They have no clue how to take those ideas and translate them into something. I have a fellow that I study with every week for many years. And we were talking on Friday, we hadn't seen each other in some time, and we got caught up. And he said something interesting to me that really, really, I still haven't figured out the answer. He said to me, "I love building the systems. I don't like running the systems." Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting thought. I'm not sure where I fit. Do I like building the systems or running the systems? Like, some people love building the structure, but they have no interest in running the machine. They just, somebody else deal with it. And some people love running the machine, but have no creativity about building it. They're different qualities. There's some people that are great at ideas, but they can't develop them. There's some people that are great at developing ideas, but they don't come up with new ideas. And by the way, if you look at our history, look at the great minds. We have both of these kind of great minds that have brought, made the world what it is. You have the people who have great ideas and introduce them to the world, and other people take those ideas and develop it. I guess you call that open sourcing, right? Is that what it's called? Open sourcing, right? You put the technology out there and then people can develop it. Okay, it's not exactly. So this is Chachma and Bina. Some people are great at Chachma, some people are great at Bina. They're both independently wonderful qualities. And for the purpose of conversation, Das is application. Some people can take an idea and develop it, but they can't apply it. It looks really good on a graduate student's paper, but it has no practical application in the real world, right? So some people are really good at application.
Some of us have a small gift for destruction.
That too. So in a world, in a corrected world, in a world of tikkun, in a world of balance, you have to have both of these qualities. And each of us ourselves need to have both of these qualities. Even if we're better at one than the other, we have to have both of these qualities. We have to come up with new ideas. When I say new ideas, they don't have to be existential ideas. You come home and your toilet is flooding, right? You get the spark of chachma. What am I supposed to do here, right? The brain says, okay, problem. Then the bina has to develop it. The next steps are, I got to call a plumber, I got to turn off the water, whatever. Now, some people are great at the idea, but they don't know how to turn the water off. They don't know actually how to turn the water off. So they know that the water has to be turned off, which is a good step, but they don't know how to do it, right? So we need all these qualities in the world of balance. And we can't fathom what is the value of being a person who has great ideas if you don't take those ideas anywhere. But if we look at them as a value unto itself, people who have the concept of being able to come up with new ideas, these powerful bolts of energy, powerful novel energy bolts, that's an amazing thing. The problem is that when the powerful bolt of energy of a new idea doesn't associate with the understanding, the development of the idea, it doesn't have longevity. As is the case with kindness that does not use any discipline, the kindness ultimately doesn't have longevity. What happens with the kindness is you hurt someone. Here, I'm trying to help you, and instead of helping you, I'm actually hurting you. What are you saying?
So if you say that in the Judd example, he lets somebody off, he's trying to be kind, and this guy is a schmo, and he lets him off, and he says, I'm going to be kind in this instance, but truly, he needed discipline, so isn't it something that's not even kindness?
Right. So what we're calling kindness becomes non-kindness. So kindness in this context, you're making a very important point. Kindness, the family of kindness, is a family of connection. It's a family of giving, right? Discipline, by definition, is holding back, right? So, by the way, discipline is also kindness when it's used correctly, right? But where is the kindness in the discipline? It's not necessarily in the act. It's in the intention of the act. So when I tell my child no, why am I telling my child no? Because there's love for my child, and therefore I'm holding back. So the kindness energy is not the dominant energy. The dominant energy is the discipline. Conversely, when I don't use discipline in the case of kindness, the dominant energy is kindness, but what's really happening is an expression of the discipline belongs to the family of strength or severity, right? That's all the force that holds back. So in this act of kindness, what ultimately lives in the core of it is severity, right? So I'm not doing good. So the idea is that kindness requires, in the world of order, kindness requires discipline, and otherwise it ultimately does not succeed as kindness. Let's put it that way. And discipline that doesn't have kindness at its core doesn't succeed at as discipline, right? And this is the world of chaos that God created. The world that God created, in Kabbalistic terms, it's called a linear world, where each of the 10 sephiros, each of these 10 qualities, the 3 intellectual and 7 emotional, live one on top of the other. You're familiar with the Kabbalistic tree. At least you've seen the images of it, right? Where you have Chachma, Bina, Das, Chesed, Gevura, Tiferes, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and Malchus. It's like three triangles and Malchus at the bottom. Not important for today's conversation exactly how that all flows, but the idea is there's a system. There's a system. Chesed belongs on the right. Gevura belongs on the left. Harmony, compassion lives in the middle. Chachma belongs on the right. Bina, we'll just make one point. Bina belongs on the left. Left is where Gevura lives. Gevura is the discipline. Bina, by definition, is Gevura, the capacity to discern, right? Understanding means I'm able to discern and discriminate. This idea doesn't belong here. This idea does belong here. This theory does belong here. The other one doesn't belong here, right? So that all belongs to the realm of understanding. The light bulb is chesed. It's a forward flow. If you try to stop the light bulb, you're not going to get the light bulb. When the new idea comes along, you got to let it flow. Just got to let it be. Let it go wherever it's supposed to go. And then you can begin to apply the discipline. So in the world of chaos, in the world of tohu, everything is on top of each other. Everything is independent of each other. There's no balance. There's no harmony. Because in that world, we have the prototype and we have the ideal structure of each of these qualities. But it doesn't survive. It doesn't have longevity. Now, it doesn't have longevity because there's a purpose in the creation. It doesn't not have longevity because there's no value to it. Let's think about that for a second. We in this world of balance, need there to be this value of pure kindness. We need that value because that informs us on the kindness that we have here. That even when we're incorporating discipline into it, the discipline that we're incorporating is a necessity, but not the ideal. As is true when we talk about the value of discipline. Discipline is a value unto itself. You may not be the discipline type personality, but if you are, and let's unpack it. You have people who are really good at order. They're really good at structure. People who are really good at order and structure are extremely valuable in every dimension of life. If you don't have order and structure, nothing that exists. Right? You have an artist come along and try to build a building. It'll fall apart. It'll look beautiful for a couple of seconds, but it's going to fall apart. So we need order and structure. We need those people who know how to take out a notebook and write mathematical equations that then become computer programming and cars and machines and houses and beautiful buildings and medical experiments and medicines. And we need that order. That doesn't come from chesed, that comes from gvura. And the person who's doing that needs to stop and recognize what the purpose is in there. Because if a person that's building out these structures forgets what their purpose is, they're going to kill it, right? You have to remember, yes, this is a great vaccine that's going to kill the disease or it's going to help a person, but it's also going to kill them, right? It looks great as a mathematical equation, but it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work at the end of the day. In theory, it'll be a beautiful building, but in reality, it's not going to work. It might work, but it's not going to work for the purpose that you're building it for, right? So, but the person who loves that discipline, the person who loves that order, the person who is of that nature is totally invested in structure. Because structure is a beautiful thing. It's a valuable thing. It doesn't work in this world as an exclusive thing, but we have to have the ideal. And the same thing is true with the person with the great novel ideas and the person who's great at developing ideas and the person that's great at applying ideas. There has to be this pure ideal so that the people who lean into these different qualities can find total value in what they're doing, even as they, so to speak, compromise to create the balance in that world. So the world of chaos wasn't a mistake. God didn't make a mistake. Oh, I made this world of chaos and now it blew up. No, and that's why God recreates it every single day, because it's a necessity. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work for the purpose that God created the world. And why did God create the world? Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, God said, let there be light. And in order for there to be light, there has to be darkness. And the light has to come from the darkness. It has to discern the darkness. So now we need balance. We need to have balance. We need to have discernment. So when God created this world of Tohu, this world of chaos, and it didn't work, and it blew up, and I'll explain in a minute what that means, it blew up, there was this shattering. And it's all divine energy, it's all godliness. So the shattering caused these sparks to fall into the world. Now, what does it mean it didn't work? What does it mean it blew up? So if you take a balloon and you fill it up with water more than it can handle, the balloon's going to bust, right? If you try to put more information into your brain than it can handle, you're gonna have a breakdown. It's the way it is. If you try to work your body beyond your body's capacity, your body's going to shut down. That's the way these things work. When kindness has no discipline to it, it breaks. You hurt someone instead of helping them. In Kabbalistic terminology, there's light and vessels. There's flow and vessels. Everything requires a vessel to receive it, to contain it, right? Our brains are a vessel for idea, for intellect. Our hearts are a vessel for blood, so on and so forth. The cup is a vessel for the coffee, right? The table is a vessel for the book, so on and so forth. When the light, which is the energy of whatever it is more powerful than the vessel breaks. You put something that's too heavy on the table collapses under the weight. Try to put too much into your brain, it breaks down. Your body, so on. Pour more water into the cup than it can handle, the cup will overflow. So in this world of chaos, there was too much light and not enough vessels. And so what happened when there was too much light and not enough vessels, the vessels blew up. The vessels exploded. And again, because we're talking about divine energy, the vessels overflowed into this world, into the world of order, and came down into this world. I'll say one more thing and then we'll take questions and stop, because we can keep on going, but we only have so much time. We only have so many vessels today. It says that there were 288 sparks that fell into the world. Now, these sparks are not one spark. These 288 sparks are not 288 individual sparks. They're primary sparks, but each of these sparks has many offshoots. 202 of them landed in what country? You know what you're going to say, and it's not the right answer. Very good. Well, what was everybody else going to say? Israel. I was going to say Israel. 202 landed in Egypt, and which is why the Jewish people were concentrated all in the land of Egypt for a specific period of time to elevate those sparks that were in Egypt. There's a lot of background to that story. It says Vagam Erev Rav Ali Itam, that the mixed multitude came up with them. We know from the Torah that there was a group of Egyptians that joined the Jewish people in the Exodus. But in Hebrew, it says Erev Rav, a mix of Rav. Rav is Resh Beis, 202. So there was a mixture of 202 sparks that were mixed into Egypt that the Jewish people brought up with them from Egypt. The Torah instructs us never to settle again in Egypt because there's no purpose in being there. The only reason why a Jew is anywhere but Israel is because we have a purpose there. We have a job to do. We have to elevate the sparks that are there. But since the Jewish people emptied it out, like the Torah says, like a net that has no fish or a trap that has no catch in it, right? No game in it. So there's nothing for us to do there. So we have 86 sparks that are spread throughout the rest of the world. And that is this long period of exile is for us to find those sparks and elevate it. That's our job. That's our purpose here. Now, what's important to kind of extrapolate from this whole discussion is that we have these two worlds. We have this world of chaos. I'm going to start using the Hebrew word for it because I want to get away from the notion of chaos because it's actually something altogether different. There's the world of tohu, and there's the world of tikkun, the world of order, the world of balance. Now, I have a question for you. Which of these two worlds is the holier of the two worlds? What would you say? You mean tikkun, the world of order. You mean the world of chaos or the world of order?
Yes. Because it
Go ahead.
The opportunity to actually do something. I mean, it gives us an incentive. If faced with a challenge, we have an incentive to try to do something about it. But if we just live, I was in the military. As long as you obeyed all the rules and everything, you didn't really have to think.
Interesting. So I'm going to say what I think what you're saying is very powerful, but I'm going to say it in different words. As long as we have the world of chaos, we have an ideal to strive for. We have the ideal to strive for. Where we live is in the world of order. But we have that ideal to strive for. I like that. What were you saying?
I suggested balance and that it doesn't take spiritual energy to kind of refine the chaos and the balance.
Yeah. So by the way, it's a little bit of a trick question. Because when we ask the question, which is holier, each one is holy in its own right. Life is lived in the world of order. So in a sense, that's the holier of the worlds because that's where life is lived. That's where the magic happens. But when we talk about more powerful energy, more powerful holy energy in its purest form, that's going to be in the world of tohu, in the world of chaos. The reality is that that's not where life is lived. So it's an ideal that exists, but it has no application other than that it's an ideal. But here's the punchline here, that from that world of tohu, which has this unbelievable, powerful energy, that energy energizes certain things in this world. So the inanimate, the vegetable life and the animal life gets its life force from the divine energy that is the world of tohu. So if you want some tohu in this world, not tofu, but tohu. Actually, if you want tohu, you got to eat tofu. But where do you, although tofu is genetically modified, but anyway, but if you want tohu, if you want to access that divine energy is going to be accessed in the physical objects. The human being does not come from tohu. We come from tikkun. The source, the spiritual source of human beings is in the world of order. That is to say that even though we too have a divine energy, the divine energy that's found in the food actually has a higher source than the human being, which is why the word of God that is within us is not adequate. We need to lean into the divine energy that's in the food in order for us to be able to sustain ourselves. I'm going to stop there, and that's where we're going to pick up the discussion next time. Next week, I am out of town, but we will pick it up the week after. Look forward to seeing everybody. Any questions? They're light. Yeah, they're light. They're light. They're obviously diminished. They don't have the same powerful force other than the fact that they originate in the world of powerful force. But they, as they descend into this physical reality, because remember, we're talking about everything we know about the mystical structure, the four worlds of Atsilas, Bria, Yetzirah, Asiya, the realm of the angels, the realm of the souls, all that stuff is post. Those are all part of the world of order. The world of Toa, the world of chaos precedes all of them. So there's this long journey that these sparks go through from their source, from the shattering, until they come into the physical object. They have many, many evolutions until they show up into this physical reality. That's why they don't look like sparks. That's why, they're terribly concealed within this world. Otherwise, if we saw them as sparks, we would have taken care of what we needed to a long time ago. But we don't know where they are. And that's why we have to do. There's actually a very interesting passage in the book written by the Rebbe. It's a quote called Hayom Yom, where the Rebbe says that Abraham, right? It says by Avraham, it says that God sent, Hashem said to him, Lech Lecha, you go forth to the land that I will show you. So it says that from that time, from the time of Abraham, the job of the Jewish people to elevate the sparks that are within the world, that job began. The responsibility to elevate the sparks began. The righteous know where their sparks are, because each of us have unique sparks that are associated with us that we have to elevate in this world, which is the journey of each of our individual lives, revolves around the sparks that are meant for us to elevate. It's also a conversation for another time, but it says that the righteous, they know where their sparks are, and they go to them and elevate them. The rest of us, God creates all of these kind of concentric circles and journeys that we have to go through until we land in the experiences that bring up those sparks for us to elevate, which is why the teaching of the Baal Shem Tov is so powerful, that everything that we experience is God's voice to us, God telling us that we have opportunity there. So when you get stuck in the airport and your flight gets canceled or delayed over and over again, and it's midnight and you're starting to get irritated, take a deep breath and say, I'm here for a purpose. There's something for me to do here. You don't necessarily have to figure it out, because sometimes it's just the awareness that I'm here for a purpose, that's where the spark is, on the seat that you're sitting in the airport, right? Or you have some irritating person in your life, or some irritating circumstance happens in your life. These are not passive events. They're all perfectly designed for you and me in our lives, for us to achieve the purpose for which we came down to this earth. And those are the sparks that are meant for us to elevate. All right. Have a great week. Find your sparks.